It is December 9th, 1:30 in the afternoon, and this is the UCF-UFF bargaining team and the UCF-BOT bargaining team, and we are ready to start rolling.
All right.
And I guess the first order of business is to look at the minutes and see if there are any changes or corrections that need to be made to the minutes.
And I think we just got the minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I just looked at it. Did anybody look at the minutes? I just saw them this morning. But I mean, I didn't have time to go through it, but let's see.
So, I have not received them. Could you?
Could
you share your screen, Tala?
Just a second. I think we just came. Right. So I will share my screen. And.
Whoa. Okay.
Can you see my screen? Wait a second. Yeah. Can you see it now?
Yes. Wait, no.
Sorry. No, you can't see it. I think.
Now I see project narrative.
Yeah. I got it. Yeah. And we have agreed, I guess, to keep the minutes as brief as possible so that then, okay. All right, so any questions on the minutes?
No.
All right. Okay. All right, so do we make a motion to... Or do we just accept?
No, we just agree that there are no changes that need to be made to the minutes.
All right. So, yeah, they're fine with me. All right. So I'll stop sharing.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the...
Yep, so my phone is ringing.
Yeah, first order of business. And so... now again, I'm going to fumble my way here, but when we left last time, we had made some discussion, and you guys were going to come back with some response, right?
Right. And I talked to the provost as recently as 11:30 this morning, and basically, we have no changes. We just don't know what's going on. We hear something different about every other day from either the BOG or the legislature, and we don't know what the heck they're doing up there. I don't know if they know either, but anyway, we don't have anything to add to what we already have on the table.
But there were some intangibles also there, right?
There were, and I, as of right now, I cannot agree to those. So that's where I am. I'm not saying that some of them aren't something that we might at some point be able to do, but I can't agree to that now.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of Giovanna, would you remind me there were three things that we had asked. One of them had to do with
reopening the layoffs article.
Yeah, the layoffs. Yeah.
Well, we have that on the table, so we can certainly we'll certainly be discussing that as when we get to it. But in terms of making that part of the 23, I can't do that right now.
Okay, and it was the other one was
going to be reopened, so that's not a question.
Yeah. So that could become earlier rather than later. And then the other one was having some sort of early retirement plan.
As I said, I have talked to people about that. I've talked to the people at South Florida because they have done that. And I kind of know how they structured that. But they have been working on that for about 9 months before they put it into action. So I have the advantage of having seen what they've done, but whether I can get, whether we would certainly have to have, I don't know, it would take us 9 months, but we would have to have some time before we can do something like that, because it's just such a big undertaking. And it's a big chunk of money to lay out, because you're putting all your money up front, essentially. You're not getting any savings initially, so.
Because I know we have, I'm sorry, Chuck, yeah, I always call it R2D2, but the TR2P, we were going to discuss that, that's Article 24.
Yeah.
So that's where we were thinking about that one. So opening that one also earlier so we can discuss those type of issues.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with opening things up on whatever timetable that you want. But as I said, I can't just jump in right now and say, okay, I'm going to agree to do this without having a lot more discussion with people around the university.
And our third was the hiring freeze, which also could be attached to the layoff article, we think.
Yeah, I think that will have to come in the layoff article.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I hope we don't have to keep using that, but I don't know.
Talat, would you like to go into caucus?
Yeah, I think we should go to caucus because I think, so Brianne, if you could put us in one. Quite a discussion, and what we realize is that right now everything is in limbo, right? I mean, we are in a lame duck period. Mm-hmm. So we have no idea what is going to be happening. And instead of our coming up with a counter proposal or making other demands, we decided that we should wait things until the next meeting, which will be on the 13th. So we'll have a little bit still, Biden will still not be, would not have been sworn in as president. There's still a chance that things may go who knows where. But at least we'll have a better idea of where we are heading. So,
the 13th, that's next year, right? January 13th.
Right.
Yeah. I had a moment of panic there when you said that. I thought, wait, we're not meeting next week.
No, 13th of January.
That's
because we don't see, you know, there's so much up in the air right now.
I agree.
With everything that, it's really, it's a waste of your time and our time. And so we will come back to this Article 23 later. We'll also open the question of layoffs and hiring freeze and all that.
We'll
get back to that on the 13th. Hopefully we'll know better.
Okay.
So I think that's what we will do, which will make life easy, I guess, for us for now. So you guys had, there were two other items, I guess, on the agenda for today. One is we would want to talk about Article 1, so then we could get it out of the way.
Okay.
Because we have some minor changes, and this was one of the ones that you had on your list. So what we're doing is going through the ones that you've already mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and we're taking a look at those, and if we can get them taken care of.
Okay, good.
So Article 1 is one that we wanted to talk about, and I believe you guys wanted to talk about Article 6?
Yes. I think that was on your list originally, and we had some changes that we needed to make in that due to the new Title IX stuff.
Right.
So we decided to go ahead and put it on the table, and you can be considering it. And I don't know what changes you wanted to make.
If you have a
proposal, you can let us know. So,
So should we do Article 1 first? That maybe, sure. maybe better. And I think Giovanna, you have the.
I think Sarah had like another meeting, so maybe Sarah should go first.
Okay. Yeah, I have another hour. I have to go at 3. So if we think Article 1 could go quickly, if not, I'd rather go first, if you don't mind, just so I can make sure we can get through 6.
I'm fine with that, if you go first.
Yeah. Okay. I think we sent it out beforehand, but do you want me to go ahead and share my screen? I can talk through my changes, proposed changes.
Sure. Also, just tell us a little bit about, let's go over it, because we'd like to know where you're coming from in terms of getting this done.
Yeah, sure. So back in August, the university published a new Title IX grievance policy. And that was, that came out of a final rule that was published back in May. And in the final rule that was published in May, they basically said you have 90 days or 100 days or whatever it was. But by August 13th, you need to have all of these changes in place. And all universities kind of went scrambling all summer to try and make sure that they could get their Title IX process into compliance with the new final rule. There were some very significant changes to that rule. And so that required us to basically create this new grievance policy and to amend, I think it was 12 to 14 university regulations, which we did over the summer. They went into effect on an emergency basis in August, and then after 90 days went into full effect. So those changes are now complete. And because of those changes, necessitates changes to our collective bargaining agreement. And what we identified is, I think it was three articles. So this is the first one. We'll also, I think, need some changes to 20. And Sherry, there was one other, I think, that we'll need to propose changes to as we go along.
Yeah, 9.
Okay, 9.
Yeah, okay. And these are fine. This is a final rule from the Department of Education.
Yes. Yes, thank you. So basically, the goal behind the rule was to redefine what sexual harassment means for Title IX purposes. And so that has also changed what sexual harassment means under our policies and procedures to some extent. So we have, you'll see throughout our changes, and I'll walk through them later on, but you'll see a distinction between sexual harassment and Title IX sexual harassment. Because what they've defined as Title IX sexual harassment is really kind of a small subset of sexual harassment as we know it, or as we have previously known it. It's really kind of the worst type of sexual harassment. And they're mandating that any sexual harassment that occurs outside of that kind of small, strict definition be dismissed from a Title IX complaint. But we as a university will still investigate it as either a Title VII sexual harassment complaint or as sexual harassment under our university policy. So there is a distinction here between sexual harassment, Title IX sexual harassment, that will be emphasized throughout. So if you see those two things being defined differently, that's why. And so there's a lot of specific procedural requirements that we have to use because of that final rule for Title IX sexual harassment cases. And that is what the Title IX grievance policy is all about. So it's a 27-page policy. It's quite involved, but it's pretty well done. Matt Rickey and OIE led the charge on that, and it reads pretty well and describes the process very thoroughly as to how Title IX will kind of go from intake all the way to the end of a case. And again, so that's basically Title IX sexual harassment. I might be oversimplifying, but it's basically quid pro quo sexual harassment. It is severe and pervasive sexual harassment. And I have to say and because it used to be that we would consider unlawful sexual harassment anything that was severe or pervasive. So it could either be really bad or be happening all the time. But now they're saying Title IX purposes, it has to be both really bad and happening all the time. And then the third group is all of the kind of violent sexual kind of crimes that fall under the VAWA and Title IX and various other federal acts. So that would be your sexual assault, stalking. There's a whole list and it's in the policy. But so that's really what they're defining as Title IX sexual harassment. But there's sexual harassment outside of that that would be dismissed under Title IX but would still be investigated under other procedures. So that's probably just a little bit of background, and I'll give some more as we go through. But that's really the impetus behind all of these proposed changes. So you'll see in A here, we've added the word unlawfully discriminate because that's what we're looking at. It acknowledges that when it comes to discrimination, there's a threshold with which it crosses the line into unlawful discrimination. So we've added that in there. And then in B, we've made the distinction between sexual harassment and Title IX sexual harassment. So we're prohibiting both. We're not just adopting the Title IX sexual harassment discrimination as our only sexual harassment definition, We're going to be addressing kind of both, although there is overlap, of course. And then as far as employees fulfilling their obligations as responsible employees, they have those obligations under both our previously existing discrimination policy and under the Title IX grievance policy. So we've just emphasized that that's a responsibility under both policies. In retaliation, we wanted to add that basically adding to the list of what could be retaliation, in addition to everything that was already in there, it could also include other conduct that would discourage a reasonable person from engaging in protected activity. It's kind of more of a catch-all to expand the definition of retaliation. Okay, so then on D, as to investigation of charges, we already had in there that charges of discrimination, harassment, and interpersonal violence would be investigated by OIE. So we just wanted to make it crystal clear that for Title IX sexual harassment, it still goes to OIE. But they'll be looking at it under the Title IX grievance policy rather than the discrimination policy that we previously had in place. And then in, let's see, that's line 58. Instead of accuser and accused, I just updated the language to complainant and respondent, because that's consistent with the language that we use in our university policies and is just considered more updated language under the final rule. And then under the results of investigation, we've made a distinction here. Again, you'll see we've added Title IX sexual harassment anytime harassment was mentioned, and we added discriminatory harassment, and that's really just to emphasize that often people say they're being harassed when they mean they're being annoyed or bothered, and that's definitely a common colloquial meaning of the word harass. But the harassment we're talking about here is discriminatory harassment, so that's harassment based on a protected class basis. So we just wanted to make that clear that that's a type of harassment that this article is addressing. Okay, so on 62, this has always been true, but we wanted to make it more explicit that OIE, for example, when they conduct an investigation, they may find that there was conduct that occurred, and while it didn't necessarily cross a line into what would be unlawful harassment or unlawful discrimination, it was getting really close, or it was leading to that, or it was still conduct that was not acceptable under UCF policies. So that's just a sentence stating that even if you don't reach that high level of a violation, because really the legal standard is quite high, there's a lot of bad behavior that wouldn't be unlawful but is still not acceptable under our employee code of conduct or university policies. So this is just an acknowledgement that even if OIE says, okay, there was no, you didn't cross the line into discrimination, but something you did may still violate the employee code of conduct or some other policy or regulation, and so discipline might still be possible. So we don't want people to be surprised. We've had some people after an OIE investigation that finds that they, you know, did a lot wrong, but then at the end it says it didn't quite meet the high threshold for severe pervasive conduct, and they feel quite vindicated. We're really, that still should be problematic that they were still found to have violated policies and procedures. And we really should be expecting more from each of all of our colleagues and ourselves, that we're doing more than just than avoiding an unlawful finding. As to, let's see, so 65, again, that's just another distinction between harassment and Title IX sexual harassment. Didn't make any changes to 6.2. And then as far as the grievance procedures, we just added that OIE would be handling any grievance that came in under this article would go to OIE. That's the same process. We just wanted to clarify again that it'll go to OIE, and they'll handle one bucket under the discrimination policy, the Title IX sexual harassment bucket under the Title IX grievance policy, but it'll still go to OIE, so that whole process is still the same. And for Article 9, Article 20, we have those timelines, of course, in place for good reason, but when it comes to OIE doing their investigations, especially in Title IX sexual harassment investigations, it's really not possible to always stick to the timelines. And so this is acknowledging that those timelines may not be able to be adhered to, especially in Article 9. It might be impossible to expedite a Title IX sexual harassment case given the new procedures that are required to be followed. And those procedures include full investigation as well as a live hearing. So that's the big change on the procedural side, is that in a Title IX sexual harassment case, no discipline can be meted out without a live hearing. And so that occurs in front of a decision maker, and each party can be represented by an advisor, can be a legal counselor, could be a friend, really could be anybody. The advisor is not really there to do anything except conduct cross-examination. So that is part of the live hearing, is a cross-examination by the advisor. And the idea is that the advisor is serving as a buffer between the parties, so you don't necessarily have a complainant, or rather a respondent, directly cross-examining a complainant, or vice versa. So they have some added level of comfort that it's a representative asking the questions, but there was a feeling by the Department of Education that that cross-examination would lead to better factual determinations, better outcomes, and get closer to the truth. There's definitely arguments on both sides about whether or not cross-examination is desirable in these types of hearings, and whether it would dissuade people from coming forward with complaints of Title IX discrimination. And those arguments were heard through the comment process on the rulemaking. And ultimately, the department was not convinced and decided that the cross-examination was basically crucial to the to their idea of what a fair process looked like under Title IX. So they required that cross-examination element in a live hearing. And so basically, the grievance, if a grievance came in under this policy or went to OIE, they would investigate. They would make a report. The investigative report would just have factual findings, would not include any recommendation as to discipline. And then it would go to a live hearing. A live hearing would be conducted. That decision maker would make a decision as to discipline. There's an appeal step both after the investigation and after the Title IX live hearing. When all those appeals are exhausted, that's when we imagine that at that point, if the faculty, imagine that the faculty respondent, say, if that faculty respondent is still dissatisfied with the process, they still maintain their full grievance right under this procedure. So rather than taking away any grievance right that our faculty already enjoyed under the CBA, they actually have additional appellate avenues under the Title IX procedure as well. So there's added layers of protection for faculty respondents under this new scheme. So in effect, it really shouldn't change much of what we do, because we still send these things off to OIE. They come back from OIE. The added difference is for Title IX sexual harassment cases, there will be a live hearing first before kind of it, quote, comes back. And then it will go through the regular grievance process. And there is the added appeal under the Title IX grievance procedure as well. And so I encourage anyone who has not read the Title IX grievance policy, the new policy, to go read it. Like I said, it is quite long, but it is pretty user-friendly. And it was intentionally tried to make it that way so people could actually understand the process and how it would go from beginning to end. And for the final change, I think I just changed the wording, because I wanted to make it clear that the grievance should indicate which protected class the person claiming discrimination is alleging the discrimination is based on. But if that wording is not clear, let me know, and we can reword that. But that's basically just the idea, and that's already a requirement. So that was just a language change. So I hope that was not incredibly confusing, and I'm sorry. We were very close to it over the summer. Took a breather afterwards, and of course now getting back into it. And just to give you an idea, because of how they've defined Title IX sexual harassment, it's such a high bar that I think in the last few years we've maybe had one or two cases involving faculty that would have reached this threshold just based on the allegations alone. And some years none, some years one or two. So this is not a policy or a policy or practice that will affect many of the faculty. But unfortunately, if we do end up in a situation where there was an allegation of Title IX sexual harassment, this is the procedure that we would have to follow. But it would be very rare. We expect it to be very rare, and of course hope it would be, because those allegations are quite serious. But there is, on the other side of things, quite a lot of process now built in to ensure that the rights of both complainants and respondents are respected, and to hopefully get the best idea, get as close to the truth as possible so we can make the best decisions as possible on both sides as to how everyone should go forward from that allegation. So if you have any questions for me now, I'm happy to answer them to the best of my ability. But if you want to review the policy in greater detail, that's fine too. And if you want to send us some questions that you have about the policy and its operation, maybe before next time, I'd be happy to have answers prepared, or we could even have maybe someone from OIE come and talk and explain part of the process in greater detail if you have questions.
I have a couple of questions. In the beginning, you distinguish sexual harassment from Title IX sexual harassment. And my question is specifically the term discriminatory harassment, as for instance used on line 107. Is sexual harassment a subset of discriminatory harassment?
Yes, so discriminatory harassment would be any type of harassment based on a protected class of which sex is one. So it could be sexual harassment, racial harassment, national origin harassment, gender identity harassment. Any of the protected classes have a harassment element. You could bring a harassment claim based on any protected class.
Okay, and then so that was one question, and then the other question is, you know, you've made some efforts to make sure that harassment that was not unlawful could still be treated by the university, which is great. I like that. But in your very first change, you specified the word unlawful, mm-hmm. which seemed to contradict the purpose of these other things. So could you again perhaps explain why we need here in line 38 to specify that no one's supposed to do unlawful discrimination as compared to discrimination in the broader sense that you're addressing later in the document?
I see your point. I want to think about that and that interaction a little more, and we'll get back to you probably on that and once we can discuss. Because I kind of, where this was coming from was, so OIE looked at this and they wanted to put it that in there, and the idea being that I think people sometimes have an expectation that everything, that there's this whole like subset of what, you know, bad behavior or behavior that people are unhappy with, and they expect that it can all be addressed by OIE, but really our university policies pretty much track the federal and state laws as to what amounts to discrimination or harassment. But there is behavior which may not violate the discrimination policy, but is still considered not, you know, not ideal behavior, but it may not be because of its discrimination policy. It could violate another policy or another regulation. So be kind of moving along that path. So it's not necessarily that they might be cleared under one, but still have a problem under another, because there's a lot of behavior that implicates many university policies and procedures. Is that, Sherry, do you agree with that?
Yeah, you see Kevin's point.
I think we probably
need to think about it a little bit more. Because it's a you know, it's one of those tricky things because it's like that term, I've lost my mind here a minute.
What is
hostile work environment? People, that has a very specific legal meaning within the context of discrimination law, but people use it in a very loose way. So if I'm just really unhappy with, if the people in my office are mean to me, or I think they're being mean to me or not very nice, people will say, well, I just have this terrible, I have a hostile work environment because I don't like who I work with and they're not nice and, you know, et cetera. And that is, has no legal meaning in that sense. So I see where she's, where we were trying to go with that, but let us think about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I appreciate it. And if that's inconsistent, we'll make those changes.
Well, in several places, what it calls for is some place where one can go and find out what is unlawful discrimination and what is lawful discrimination, right? I mean, who defines that? The same thing goes with sexual harassment and Title IX sexual harassment, right? We are basically asking the question.
Yeah, well, yes. So, and Title IX sexual harassment. I'm sorry, Sarah. I'm just jumping in right on top.
No, please. Like, we've been, Sherry and I have been working on this together all year, so yeah. You're one mind.
They have elevated that to it's a much higher standard now. So whereas Title VII, it would be severe or pervasive. Mm-hmm. Behavior would be considered unlawful. Under Title IX, it has to be both severe and pervasive. That takes it to a totally different level. So there are subtle changes like that, but they make a difference in terms of how things get treated.
Go ahead, Sherry.
Go ahead.
I would say if an allegation came in, OIE would look at it. If it's potentially implicated Title IX, they would have to do a jurisdictional review basically and say, mm-hmm. Is this severe and pervasive? So let's say it's something horrible, but it only happened once. So they know for sure it's not severe and pervasive. They would probably be required under those circumstances to issue a mandatory dismissal under Title IX. That doesn't mean that they are not going to investigate it. That just means it doesn't go down the Title IX path to a live hearing. So then they just pick it up as a Title VII investigation or an investigation of our, just a violation of our university policy, and then they apply the severe or pervasive standard, and that's kind of what they're looking for. So there is still, they want to still have an eye on everything. Nothing is going to be kind of falling through the cracks here. It's just a matter of what has to go to a live hearing versus what doesn't under the department rules. So they're requiring mandatory dismissals of Title IX cases that don't reach certain jurisdictional thresholds. For example, it has to have occurred in the United States. So if it was, even if it was a sexual assault, but it was in one of our study abroad programs, we'd have to dismiss under Title IX, but that doesn't mean OIE would not investigate under their own kind of jurisdiction, but it just wouldn't get the live hearing treatment that the Title IX policy requires.
So are we expecting some changes in these also with the change of government?
I think that is a distinct possibility, and I know a lot of people have already approached the Biden team about that because, and I don't want to get too much into the legal weeds here, but because this was done as through the formal rulemaking process under the Administrative Procedure Act, it would have to be undone in the same way. It can't be just, you know, like some of the things that we've been talking about recently, like the sexual harassment the order, executive order, Biden can just trash Trump's executive order and issue his own. You can't do that with something that's gone through the formal rulemaking process. So our best guess is that even if on day one he announced that Biden announced that he wanted to get rid of this rule, it will take somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 18 months to get this one repealed and a new one put in place. So yes, I think it's highly likely that this will not stand, but we're going to be with it for a while.
And that's why you want to have it in place, because this spells out things.
Yes, because this is the current law. It is law now. So, until it gets repealed, we're stuck with it. And I can tell you that almost nobody that I know of likes it.
So we were part of the reason why they created a Title IX grievance policy separately rather than just amending our discrimination policy was knowing that this might go away in the future, because we were doing this pre-election, not knowing at all if it was going to be permanent or semi-permanent. And so the idea being that if it is done away with and we kind of go back to the Obama era guidances, that we kind of have one policy that we could chuck in the bin, and then we have our kind of track changes that we could go back to our original regulations. So that was at least some of the thinking. If it does go away, that we kind of have an easier way to track what we did. Because I think everyone felt pretty comfortable with the process as we had before, and that it struck the proper balance between complainants and respondents, and also provided appropriate levels of protection and support for both sides. And that this one, these changes were pretty explicitly focused on adding layers and protection for respondents specifically.
So I think, given that there is some confusion and some questions, maybe we should take a look at it and get back again on.
Yeah, we certainly did not expect you to just jump up and down and say, oh, this is wonderful.
Right.
Yay on it today. Right. We know you're going to have to take it back.
Yeah.
Spend some serious time with it and look at the actual policy too, because it's a bear.
So what's in black is the actual policy?
Well, no.
What's in black is our previous article, the language that we didn't change.
That's the status quo, and the red is the changes. The policy is on our policy website, and it's 27 pages long. So,
it's 2-012.
Incorporate that into the article.
So that's 2-012.
Yep. And if you just go to the UCF policies, that's how you usually find it, and just search Title IX, it's on that page.
Right.
Hold on, I'll email it to you.
Yeah. Okay. So this, that policy is the policy right now. And so
yes.
This basically makes it. Okay.
A lot of it is, there is a significant chunk that deals with employees. A lot of it, when I say it's 27 pages, a lot of it deals with students, because there were major changes on the student side.
Well, if it's Title IX, then quite a bit of it will be.
Yes.
All right. Okay, well, thanks. I think we'll certainly take a look.
Okay, you're welcome.
Hopefully Article 1 is easy.
Well, after that.
Nothing is easy. Nothing. Yeah, after that, this one was, again, we had an interesting times because, there's a possibility that things will change, hopefully. So Giovanni, do you want to go ahead with?
Yes, I can do that. Thank you, Talat. So let me bring this on. Okay. All right. So I'll start from the beginning. So this is Article 1. Mostly made some minor changes. I will bring up some of the our rationale for some of the new language. So one of the things I've noticed in some of the language, I know the board, and maybe the board doesn't need to be in here. I know the past language has always been the university, but I noticed that other universities and UCF is also talking about the board and board of trustees a little bit more often than usual. So I added the board, but if you guys want to delete that, that's fine too. Because I know that the board is, you know, it's on our paychecks and it's like the main owner, owns all of us. So 1.1, all I did was I separated the big paragraph into nice, neat little sentences here. So the first one, it's the same language. I just removed some of the like pursuant to, because that was like legacy language. So the board and the universe recognize the university, United Faculty of Florida, as exclusive representative for the bargaining unit, certified, and that's our certification information. The university recognizes, or board, if we add the board, then recognize the UFF as the exclusive representative for the bargaining unit, solely for the purposes of collective bargaining with respect to all those issues there. And since I separated those two sentences, I gave the sentence where it says attaches appendix A its own line as well, like a C. I think it also makes it more inviting for people to actually read Article 1 and to know that this is a process, that there is, you know, we have an actual certification number and everything. And so I just cleaned it up. 1.2, this is new language, bargain unit position classifications, creation of a new class. This is a bit like kind of, I don't know if Charlie's here, but I can't see her. But we've had this conversation before about classifications and everything. And so if there is a new classification, and I will say this language is in some of the other state universities, like FSU has this. And actually theirs is much lengthier than this one. So I just borrowed a little bit of their language. So if there is, the board or the state creates new classifications, that there will be some discussion with UFF to determine the necessity and nature of the new position classification. And whether it should be designated within or outside the bargaining unit. So that's the new language there. This one here, I just, if any proposed, I cleaned up the language before because, you know, a lot of there is, there was, but a lot of passive language, so I made it more into active voice. And before it was university agrees to promptly remedy the inconsistency. I just added like, what are you actually doing? So UFF shall be explicitly notified and provide an opportunity to address the matter. And that's de facto. You guys are already doing that. You send emails to the president, then UFF president, then they send it to us. So new or amended university regulation. This is kind of the practice. I just cleaned up the language a little bit. On line 35, I just had a question if it's still called Administrative Procedure Act, because I have noticed that some of the policies have now changed some of the language and wording. So I just wanted to double check on that. So nothing substantial there. Instead of making it a negative, I made it into a positive. Again, just changing some, tweaking the language. So instead of saying the UFF shall not be denied the opportunity, the UFF shall be explicitly notified and provided the opportunity to address matter in this category here on line 41. Lines 43 to 45. I mean, I know just from the emergency situation of the past year, we've had, three MOUs, impact bargaining. So I wanted to, again, have language that reflected our actions, our, you know, what we're actually doing here in bargaining. So I added this sentence here on 44, policies bearing on a matter that is proper subject of collective bargaining shall be made through negotiation agreement with the UFF. And I did not say specific like impact bargaining, but I just kind of left it open there a little bit. Here, just a little board of trustees meetings, the agenda, you know, we receive the agenda, just making sure that that continues, and just added some language about like the committee or subcommittee, because at least the last time I checked, it looks like a lot of the work gets done via subcommittee. Right to hear 1.4, I didn't make any changes, and I apologize, I didn't change all the numbers. So 1.4 is now 1.5, I'll do that now. Okay. And the last one here, so faculty orientations. So I added, again, language that is more reflective of what you're doing. And also another permission thing that I know we've always been allowed to sponsor something at the fall orientation, but here I added some language that, you know, at all orientation meetings, expressly for faculty members, that we'd be able to, like either in person online or via video conferencing, at least be able to address our collective bargaining unit to make presentations, distribute informational material, and then of course continue the practice of being able, given the opportunity to sponsor a breakfast, a lunch, or reception at the fall faculty orientation.
Okay, lots of changes there.
It looks like it, but it's not. It's more like reflecting like what we're doing.
Huh? Hmm? What was that, Charlie?
I said there are some substantive changes there.
Yeah, there definitely are.
1.2 is probably the substantive. The other one's a little bit more language and a few sentences here and there.
No, I think there are more than you think, perhaps.
Yeah, but, I do too.
It'll take us some time to look those over and discuss.
Yeah. Okay,
did you have any that didn't require more discussion? Did you have any that looked like, or are we going to go through this for every single article?
I don't think so.
No. Okay, well, we will take a look at those and talk it over with our team and with other parties that need to be involved and respond to you at the next, at a future meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I just had a question. So I know there's some like that they're just like small changes, like in Article 22, just adding that line. So would those be considered in the easy pile? Because I know before you talked about easy, medium, difficult.
Sure. Okay.
Well, they gave us what they thought were easy.
Well, we gave you the ones that we thought we could just...
And one, and we started with one thinking that would be the easiest, and it's not easy, so...
No, it's not. You get some.
Well, I'm going to send it to you.
I think the one that I did have a question on, and maybe you can answer, had to do with sabbatical, because that I was asked by my chair to... And then I've got conflicting opinions on that. Because that was the whether it is 7 years, the seventh year, or whether it is not.
Yeah, that's what Yvonne just mentioned was Article 22, which is sabbaticals.
Okay.
We may have some tweaks around there too, but I think we're on along the same lines of making sure that it's clear from this point. So I think that makes sense.
Okay, so 22 is one that we could put on a list for.
Well, we know it needs tweaks. It's not, how do I put it? It's not something we can just TA just the way it is, which is what we intended for Article 1, 2, et cetera, et cetera.
We had
no plan changes. If you have plan changes, we'll be happy to discuss them. 22, we know that there's going to be a few little minor things. We'd like to address the ones that we hope don't have any changes as soon as possible and get them put to the side.
Okay. Yes, that's our intention too. We have been a little bit too caught up with other things, but we will... We're looking at the list, and hopefully we can get to a few of them on.
And I'm sorry, my computer changed my sound settings today without warning, so it took me a while to get some help to address them. Did we talk at all about making sure that those days that had been sent are okay? That was on the agenda to talk about, and I don't know if we did or not.
Why don't we just put that? You have it. I can do my screen or somebody else can do their screen. It's the 13th and then
it's every 3 weeks starting in January. And I think
when I looked at it, at least for me, there was no conflicts, but I don't know about the others.
Well, you're the most important person for the UFF in the Zoom room.
Right. is there a problem, a glaring problem with any of the dates?
Not on my side, no.
So, not on my side.
Okay.
Great. Ennis can send them out. Again, if we've dropped anybody off or they feel like they're not getting the holds, please contact Brandis and she'll put the invitation in there. I think Zoom has recently changed its settings a little bit, so it's a little bit harder for people to come in and just do foolish stuff. So
we are getting input on and our first input is on this 8 or 9 that you mentioned to me.
Right.
And that everyone is looking at. So
hopefully not too much input. Hopefully it's like, yes, it's good as it is. That's what we're
looking at. You know how it goes. And this has been a bad time because people were busy. Yes. But we hope that, you know, in the next 2 weeks, we'll have that resolved. Great. And then we'll let you know which ones are...
All right, well, with that, then Brianna's can go forth and make the public announcements, set that on the calendars. There's a lot of different pieces that go into scheduling a meeting. It's more complicated than it looks, so I'm very grateful to have her take care of those things for me. She gets it on the website and all those things.
That would be great. And Brianna's, could you please send it to me at my UCF address? I'll send an email too, because then it goes directly into my calendar. And I think this is lawful.
Maybe she can invite you on both platforms, and that way there's no issues.
Yeah. One other question that I did want to just clarify is that when we have our own meetings, could we use UCF Zoom? I wanted a clarification on that.
I talked to Robert about that just yesterday. I sent authorization for him to use his Zoom room for a UFF meeting in the spring semester, and that we would talk about it for any future semesters, but he has not, unless you want to exceed 200.
Sorry, Charlie, can I clarify?
Of course.
The request for anyone to organize committee meetings through their Zoom, which is
right.
What you approve.
If you're keeping it under 200 people, I'm going to authorize it. He asked me specifically, and I replied in writing because I feel like then you can always wave that at someone saying, I have permission, right? So it's well and good for me to say something during a meeting, but that's why I like an email, because it just says, yes, you're good.
But Talat's question was whether she could use it.
Yeah, I can do it. So for example,
the committee chairs can use their UCF Zoom.
Yes. Okay.
So I'm organizing meetings otherwise, right? But if I want to have a meeting of, let's say, my caucus or the council,
yes.
If I want to have them call them, for example, I would like them to just talk to me about these 8 articles that you've
given. Of course. If you have all your dues-paying members on it, it might be a problem, right? Because I don't want to exceed...
No. It won't be that.
I'm just saying, you know, just like so I can be clear, there's a boundary there that you can exceed if things got crazy. But for simple committee meetings and for the purposes of a breakout, of breaking out to have your own discussion, that's perfectly fine. Does that make sense?
It's very easy for me to do, but not that we would get that many people. But why are you saying 200 and not 300?
I believe that our Zoom license that we purchased cannot exceed a certain number, and I can't remember the number. I can't remember if it was 100 or 200, but if you have more than 100 people in your room, you need to think about that. If you're talking, you know, fewer than 50 or something, I'm not worried about it. But getting up toward 100 people, then I may have to look into whether or not we have licensing ability to do it.
Yeah. No, our licensing ability is 300.
Okay, 300. All right. Okay. I couldn't exactly remember. I knew it was 100-something, so.
you know why I know, Charlie? There were 288 students in my class.
Okay, there you go.
All right.
I had a couple questions.
Yes,
I always, Talat, to your question, I always thought it's just, we just can't use it for like political meetings or politicized or to meet with governors or whoever might show up. But actually my question is about Article 25 insurance deductions. So I don't really understand what it is. And then just in the past 5 years, which I've sat in all these meetings, it's never really known what it is. I actually even asked Marshall at one point, like 2 years ago, the executive director of UFF, and I didn't really get a good answer. Do you guys know what it is?
What is?
Article 25, which is insurance deductions.
Oh, well, I think that's taking money out of your paycheck, right? It's been there since the 1970s.
Yeah, your UFF insurance deduction.
Right. So I suppose at one time, I'm guessing wildly, Sherry, but I'm guessing that because we're taking money out of a paycheck, they wanted to have it in the collective bargaining agreement. But that's a guess.
Because Article 26 is the payroll deduction. So
this isn't about,
I don't know what UFF voluntary economic services programs you have. Apparently at one time you had some.
But, okay, so you want me to double check with the UFF?
And we agreed that we would deduct for those from your paycheck. And you're supposed to be providing us with a written report by July 31st.
I know.
And I don't know if we're even, I don't know if we're even doing this.
Yovana, check also to see that right now the UFF is, it asks for 1% dues deduction.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me at one point that they could change that to another percentage. And that's the next one, Article 26. But I in my head, I remember there being some sort of blend because I remember Dawn Truard. Do you remember that, Sherry? Dawn Truard changed something, and all she had to do was let payroll know, but they had to let them know by July 31st what they wanted to do in the upcoming academic year. So there's something, but I can't remember what it was. But, you know, when I say Dawn Truard, I mean, she's retired. It tells you how long it's been since I remember something happening.
Okay.
I can ask payroll.
We're still 1%, and UFF is going to have a new executive director starting in January, so I think they're going to keep it for now at 1%.
Do we have a named person, or are they going to select in January?
We do, but they have to officially announce it.
Okay. They have.
I'm on the steering committee. That's why I know all these, like, little things. But
does that mean Ogletree is retiring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's officially retiring as of December 31st.
Okay.
Yeah, so I know I just wanted to ask you if that was something that you guys had implemented, or your insurance deduction is something that came out of the 70s.
No, it's some kind of, for the, it's UFF Voluntary Economic Services Programs. I don't know what your economic services programs are. So,
okay.
Find out what they are. And if it's something that you're no longer doing, and I can certainly check with payroll to see if they are even implementing.
Actually, could you check with payroll? Because I think that might have been like the insurances, because you know how we get in the mail from FEA, Florida Educational Association, we get in the mail like, oh, would you like to have car insurance, home insurance through
us? Yeah, we get that from the Florida bar too. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it was something where the payment for that must have been at one point taken out of the paychecks.
Okay.
I don't think that happens anymore.
Yeah, because you have to list the provider companies that we're supposed to be giving the money to. So, I'm assuming that's what that was. But we'll find out, and if we don't need it, it's one less article we have to worry about.
Yeah, and then Article 26, too, I thought that was, it's vague enough that I don't think there need to be enough changes.
Yeah. With Article 26, although, Charlie, was there something about...
Okay, so this is the thing. I put in, I gave the UFF, this, I don't know how to say this nicely. Let me back up. Okay, so there's no mandatory reason why the UFF needed to have dues deductions forms filled out and sent to us.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's easier for you guys to keep track of for your membership, et cetera. So when this was changed, I felt like it put more of a strain on the UFF than the previous system. But we can continue to do it the same way. But right now, you're still having the dues deductions forms completed and sent to me rather than sending me the spreadsheet that we talked about.
Yes. Oh, unfortunately, someone passed away. So,
yes, I know. That
she was doing the spreadsheet.
Her to do that, she was extremely useful and just a really good person in general. But yes.
So is the person sending it to you right now is Jan?
Yes. And forms? He's still sending me forms rather than the spreadsheet design that I keep sending that we agreed to do in lieu of the system that we had before. If you want to revert to the previous system and put the dues deduction form back in under Appendix B, we can talk about that.
Okay, so that's why Article 26 was not on your automatic. Okay.
Well, actually, I think it was. We can go forward. It's just a matter of I felt like it was more of a burden on you than it was on me.
Okay, so, I will. Yeah, so that's, I think that's.
26 was not on my list.
Okay. Yeah, it was not on my list either.
Okay. 26, I think we can be flexible with going back to the old language.
Yeah, we really don't care. I mean, we don't have a dog in this hunt, but that was one of those things that it was like we agreed to do it because there was no legal reason why we couldn't.
Yeah.
And
so,
but it seemed like it wasn't.
Well, the more they can do, the better for us.
Because Pat was, I think, fine with the spreadsheet, but then...
Well, yeah. she actually, I don't think, was fine. It was like a technology thing that she wasn't happy with.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know. I'm sorry.
But it depends on your
personal... Aren't all things happening electronically now?
It just required a spreadsheet to be sent to me, and the spreadsheet had the list of people to add and the people to remove. And that was supposed to happen, and I was going to send it to payroll every couple of weeks. And it was, you know, we were going to have a system because it was pounded into me that you don't have to do it the way we were doing it. Well, okay. But now I'm still receiving the form, which is no longer in the CBA. So I find that to be a little awkward, and which I suggest, we were going to suggest to you that maybe you stop sending me the forms, or we put the form back in or something. You know what I mean? Something to address that issue.
Okay. So just kind of a little background. Yeah, there was a little bit of shifting because of COVID and everything, because they were doing like still physical copies, but then we went into an online form.
That's what I thought we had happened.
Yeah, so that's what happened over the
but
COVID
I shouldn't
period.
Be receiving a form.
If I know, I understand. So I will, yes.
You know what I mean? So I'm just trying to abide by, to go by the book.
I know. No, I understand.
If there's a practice, it better be in it. Yeah,
yes.
We'll have to do that, yeah.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter to us, but, you know, we
because
need to bring it up
to while, you. Every once in a while, good people who are staff members sign the dues deduction forms, and when we look them up, they're not in unit. People, right? They just want to be part of it. I don't blame them. Like, hey, yay! But so I have to have the names checked. Brianna checks them now for me, but I used to check every single name and make sure, and then the form, make sure it was signed within the last 6 months, because people changed their mind after 6 months, right? And so we just kind of kept it fresh like that, which is why we wanted the UFF to maintain the list and to send us changes, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's it from our side, right?
Yes, I will send you Article 1 that I have to all of you.
Yovana, did you make a change to 1 that wasn't tracked? I couldn't tell. You were changing 1.4, and I couldn't tell what was happening.
The numbers are a little off. I'm going to change that really quick. That's all it is.
Just make sure they're all tracked from the status quo, right?
Yes, so yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. That's all I care about. As long as we're tracking it from status quo, that makes sense.
And I put it at the top. So I copied your from status quo.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Well, good meeting. We will
see you
guys bargaining next year.